This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Max Kennedy never knew his father well. Max was 3 when Robert Kennedy was assassinated 30 years ago. He died on June 6, 1968. Now Max Kennedy has edited a book of his father's speeches and favorite literary quotations called Make Gentle the Life of This World, The Vision of Robert Kennedy. He hopes it will show that although his father was known as a tough attorney general, powerful senator, and brother of a president, his inner life was deeply connected to his favorite books of literature and philosophy. We invited Max Kennedy to talk with us about his father. Max writes in the introduction to his book that he felt some trepidation at the task of spending so much time thinking about his father. I asked him why.
My father was killed, obviously, when I was a very little boy, and I would say that his absence was probably the greatest factor in my life, and obviously that was a painful and an aching absence for me. And while I've dealt with many of the issues surrounding that, I think it's something, the death of a father is something that is very difficult to deal with it at any stage in a life. I remember reading in a novel by Umberto Eco that he had one sentence in this novel where he said, there's no use figuring out how to deal with the death of a father because you'll never have to deal with it again. And I think a lot of reading this stuff and thinking about him was sort of delving into grief and to some extent suffering, and that's a hard thing to do. There was when I began this project, I was trying to think of whether to do it or whether not to do it, and I read a translation of a poem by a German poet, and I came across a couple of lines from the Duino Elegy. And it said, "How dear you will be to me then, you knights of anguish. Why didn't I kneel more deeply to accept you, inconsolable sisters, and, kneeling, lose myself in your loosened hair? How we squander our hours of pain." And that poem really helped me to kind of see the value in delving deeply into this stuff. I mean, I think the Bible says that pain is the touchstone to spiritual growth, and I felt that I had a real opportunity here in sort of diving deeply into this.
In your new collection of your father's speeches, you have something that he said on the death of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, and I thought this would be an appropriate thing for you to read as we get close to the anniversary, the 30th anniversary of your father's assassination. Would you read an excerpt of this for us?
Sure, I will. These words were spoken, I don't know if you know, Terry, but my father was scheduled to speak in Indianapolis that evening, and while he was on the plane, he got word that Dr. King had been shot and was going to die. This announcement had not been made public, so it fell to my father to give this terrible news to the people of Indianapolis. And he was scheduled to speak in what was then called the ghetto. And as his escort drove into one of the poorest areas in the city, the police who were escorting him pulled away and refused to drive in. My father's car continued, but the car carrying his speech followed the police officers. So he found himself that night in this very poor area with no speech. And he started by saying, "I have bad news for you, for all of our fellow citizens, and for people who love peace all over the world. And that is that Martin Luther King was shot and killed tonight." And at that point on the recording, there's a terrible gasp from the crowd. And then my father picks up again and he says, "Martin Luther King dedicated his life to love and to justice for his fellow human beings, and he died because of that effort. In this difficult day, in this difficult time for the United States, it is perhaps well to ask what kind of a nation we are and what direction we want to move in. For those of you who are black, considering the evidence there evidently is that there were white people who were responsible, you can be filled with bitterness, with hatred, and with a desire for revenge. We can move in that direction as a country, in great polarization, black people amongst black, white people amongst white, filled with hatred toward one another. Or we can make an effort, as Martin Luther King did, to understand and to comprehend, and to replace that violence, that stain of bloodshed that has spread across our land, with an effort to understand with compassion and love. For those of you who are black and are tempted to be filled with hatred and distrust at the injustice of such an act against all white people, I can only say that I feel in my own heart the same kind of feeling. I had a member of my family killed, but he was killed by a white man. But we have to make an effort in the United States. We have to make an effort to understand, to go beyond these rather difficult times. And then he quoted from memory his favorite poet, Aeschylus, and he said, "My favorite poet was Aeschylus. He wrote, 'In our sleep, pain which cannot forget falls drop by drop upon the heart, until in our own despair, against our will, comes wisdom through the awful grace of God.'" And he finished that speech by asking the people there to go back to their homes and to say a prayer for the family of Martin Luther King, and also to say a prayer for the United States. And the remarkable thing is that that night there were riots across the country. I think there were riots in 186 cities and towns in the United States, and Indianapolis was quiet.
Max Kennedy, did that speech give you any clues on dealing with your father's assassination?
Yes, I think it definitely did. It's really a remarkable speech. I think that when a violent act occurs like that, the temptation is immediately to respond with hatred and with anger and with a vengeful heart. And the lesson that my father tried to give is to, the old Christian ethic, which is to try to respond with love. And in fact, I took the title of this book from something he said later that same night in that same speech. He said to this incredibly poor audience, who had every right to be unimaginably angry, he went back and he quoted the ancient Greeks again, which I think is a remarkable thing, and he said, "Let us dedicate ourselves to what the Greeks wrote so many years ago, to tame the savageness of man and make gentle the life of this world." And I mean, in the final analysis, my feeling is that this world could still use a lot more gentleness.
My guest is Max Kennedy. His father, Robert Kennedy, died 30 years ago this Saturday. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Max Kennedy. He's edited a book of his father Robert Kennedy's speeches and favorite literary quotations called Make Gentle the Life of This World. Max Kennedy, you were 3 when your father died. I'm wondering what you thought about as you watched your son become the age you were when your father died, and that age was 3.
Well, I thought a lot about my father during that time, and I thought about myself and what I was like, and I thought often of what it would be like for that little boy to lose his own father and what it must have been like for me to have this. I mean, for him, when a child is 3.5 years old, the father is an incredibly important force in their lives, and to have that yanked away and disappear, I thought very often and long about that.
Do you have firsthand memories of your father, or are your memories mostly through what you've seen and read since his assassination?
Well, I was 3.5 years old when my father was killed, and I do have certain vague memories that you would expect from someone who's that young. I don't I would rather not speak of them. I would rather not talk about them specifically.
Mm-hmm, that's fine.
But I remember being with him, and isn't that the most important thing?
You describe yourself in your new book as having built a life somewhat independent of the Kennedy mystique, and I'm wondering if that's very difficult to do.
Well, I said somewhat, so I think it is hard to do. I don't think I was trying particularly hard, though. All that I meant by that was that I have I've avoided to a large extent being in any way in the public eye, and I'd spent much of my career as an assistant, serving as an assistant district attorney in Philadelphia, where my name mattered very little. You know, in the courtrooms, and certainly the defendants had no idea that it was Robert Kennedy's son who was prosecuting them.
Did your father's work inspire you to go into law?
Definitely it did. I was also very inspired by my brother Bobby, who's an environmental lawyer in New York State. So I think Bobby was probably inspired by my father, and I looked at his example and loved what he did.
You wrote a magazine article for Double Take about how in 1992, after graduating law school, you joined the DA's office in Philadelphia. And you write, "I believed that my enthusiasm and hard work and good intentions would make a difference. I believed that the law would make a difference. And then I was assigned to the juvenile unit." And you conclude in the article that the juvenile justice system doesn't work. Would you give us a kind of very compressed version of your critique of the juvenile justice system, the way you witnessed it?
Sure. There's been, in the last decade, an explosion in juvenile crime, and an explosion in the seriousness of the crimes committed by juveniles. I think in 1965, there were two juveniles arrested in the city and county of Philadelphia for narcotics offenses. And in my last year at the DA's office, there were just over 9,000. And the system is just completely not set up to deal with that kind of an explosion. And so the juveniles that should go to treatment are kept home, and the juveniles who should be locked up are sent to treatment. And so the treatment programs can't work or don't work, many, many juveniles are left on the streets to commit more crimes because there's not room in the system to deal with them.
I think, you know, when you're an idealistic person and you're working in a dysfunctional system, you have two choices, and it's really hard to choose between the two. One is, I have to leave, this system isn't working. And the other is, this system isn't working, I am idealistic, I must change, I must stay and change it, I must try to fix it. Was it a very difficult decision for you to go rather than to stay and try to change the system?
It was extraordinarily difficult. That's a very perceptive question. You must have had some experience with this personally. It was one of the most difficult decisions that I've made in the last 10 years, and I have so much respect and admiration for my coworkers who have stayed on there and dedicated their lives, because I think they really do make an incredibly important difference to the victims of crime. On the whole, in the great balance of the crimes being committed, we made very little difference. But in the lives of a victim who's come in and had the defense attorneys against them, and had this terrible crime committed, they have always at least one friend in the courtroom, and that's the prosecutor.
So what was, when you did the math about whether you should stay or whether you should go, what kind of led you to make the decision that you'd go?
Well, finally, I was very lucky in the end, because my wife was offered a teaching position at Harvard University. So I had a very good reason to leave.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Otherwise, I may well have continued there for a very long time. So I count myself very lucky for my wife's good employment.
You know, your father said in one of the speeches that you quote, "There is no greater need than for educated men and women to point their careers toward public service as the finest and most rewarding type of life." Did those words ring in your ears when you were trying to figure out what to do?
That's funny.
Just like one more thing to make you feel guilty.
Yeah, there's another quotation in this book from Aristotle, which it's Aristotle or Plato, and it says the old Greek definition of happiness is the full use of one's powers in a life affording them scope. And I think that's kind of another way of defining happiness or fulfillment. And for me, I think that I really learned from my older brothers and sisters and from my mother that the important thing in life was to be fulfilled. And I have discovered after trying numerous different careers that that fulfillment comes most easily from a life that is involved in public service. It's simply the most fun way for me to live my life. And that's why I do it, not out of some sort of sense of obligation or filial piety or this kind of thing. And I think that's what my father, I'm sure, would have wanted. And I know it's what my mother would want.
What kind of work are you doing now?
I'm actually starting a new job in the fall, teaching at Boston College and running an institute at Boston College, which is developing teacher training programs for inner city high schools to improve the science curricula in the poorer neighborhoods in Boston.
Well, that relates to juvenile justice in the sense that, you know, trying to help kids before.
Well, that's exactly right. We're trying to get the young people in the inner city neighborhoods involved in the outdoors, and I can tell you that I've prosecuted more than 1,000 juveniles in Philadelphia, and not one of them had ever been to any kind of a park outside of the city. And there's enormous opportunity to experience the outdoors in Boston, and that's one of the things we're going to try to do. So,
did you ever consider entering electoral politics?
From time to time, the idea of running for office enters my head, but I usually push it out very quickly. And I know that for the next several years, I'm going to be extraordinarily busy teaching and working at the Watershed Institute at Boston College. So I heard my brother Bobby say the other day, "I have no plans, and I have no plans to make plans," and I kind of like that.
My guest is Max Kennedy. His father, Robert Kennedy, died 30 years ago this Saturday. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Max Kennedy. He's edited a book of his father, Robert Kennedy's speeches and favorite literary quotations called Make Gentle the Life of This World. As you know, your generation of Kennedys has been very closely watched by the press and by the public, and there's been articles with headlines like, "Third generation of Kennedys has been scarred by drugs, death, alcohol, sexual improprieties, and marriage problems." Do you think that there are different pressures facing your generation than your father's generation?
Well, the first thing to remember is that I come from an extraordinarily large family. I have something like 30 cousins, first cousins on my father's side alone. And the vast majority of them are living productive, full lives. They're raising children in states all around the country. They're doctors and they're lawyers and they're practicing public interest law. And some of us are teachers. And we're all of my cousins are contributing in some way to their family and to their friends and their neighbors and to some extent to their society, whether they're raising children or producing in some other way. And I think that every family in America has individuals who go through difficult times. And I think almost everybody in their life at some point goes through a difficult time. And the thing is, in my family, when someone has a challenge that they're dealing with, it often makes its way into the press. And it's those kinds of things that make headlines rather than the balanced life that I see amongst my cousins.
Max Kennedy, I'd like you to choose something from the new book you've edited of your father's speeches, and something that's particularly meaningful to you.
This is a passage that my father wrote, I think, in 1967. And the reason that I chose it is I've been asked recently a lot about the private lives of public figures. And this quote brings to mind the issues that I think I'm most concerned about with the private lives of public figures. Obviously, it was difficult for most of my brothers and sisters to share my father growing up with so many others. And the interesting thing to me is, in 1967, a group of medical doctors went and traveled through Appalachia, which was an area of the country that had been widely ignored, especially by national politicians. And when they came back, they found extraordinary. They found an awful lot of malnutrition. You know, children who were going to bed hungry and even starving. And there was really no response for them. They were unable to even get an interview with anyone in the administration. And they were unable to speak with any of the senators who were dealing with those kinds of issues. Finally, one of them got my father's telephone number at home, and he called him on a Saturday. My father invited him over, and they began to talk. And by that evening, my father had called 13 or 14 other senators and begun to write legislation and spoken with the various cabinet officials who would be involved with it. And I'll tell you what he said about it. He wrote this in a speech soon after that. He said, "There are others from whom we avert our sight. Some of them are in the hills and hollows of the Appalachians. That is proud land, and these are proud men who have rallied to the nation's flag at every hour of danger. But the deep mines are closing and the jobs have gone, leaving men without work, many of them crippled by the accidents and disease that lurk down in the mines. Their land a ruin of strip mines and stinking creeks. Their children are ravaged by worms and intestinal parasites. They eat bread and gravy and sometimes beans. And as one of them says, when another child is born, we just add a little water to the gravy." And I think that as a result of those efforts, the food stamp program was born. That's how food stamps were created. And these children, you know, first began to get decent nourishment. And to me, it's incredibly interesting, you know, how a man who comes from a life or from a family that's extraordinarily well-to-do, who could spend his Saturday doing almost anything, would choose to meet with these doctors and then sit down and create a plan and get legislation through so that children do not have to suffer as much in this country.
Your father, Robert Kennedy, was assassinated 30 years ago. Are anniversaries particularly difficult for you, or do they offer a particularly good time for reflection?
Well, I think both. Reflective times are often very difficult times, and certainly these kind of anniversaries bring up the aching of his absence. But I don't think any of us would want it any other way.
What do you mean?
Well, I don't think I would want to live a life in which my love for my father was such that at least on certain days of the year, I didn't feel an aching for him.
Max Kennedy, I want to thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for interviewing me, Terry.
Max Kennedy has edited a new book of his father's speeches and favorite literary quotations called Make Gentle the Life of This World, The Vision of Robert F. Kennedy. Max was 3 when his father was assassinated. This Saturday marks the 30th anniversary of his death.